Here we go. If you are sitting comfortably, I will begin. Dear Ajahn, Samatha meditation calms the mind. Vipassana meditation develops wisdom. Both these practices are aimed towards understanding Four Noble Truths. You lay more emphasis on the former. Are you going to touch on the latter at any time? Thank you for your excellent Dhamma teaching made so simple. Okay, I say this story every retreat. There was this couple. They were really very devout meditators. And the lady was called Vipassana. And the partner, the guy, was called Sam Atta. And they had two dogs, Metta, the female dog, and Anapanasati, the male dog. And one day after lunch, Sam and Vi decided to go on a walk up Meditation Mountain. And of course they took their two dogs. And Sam went up the top of Meditation Mountain because it's so peaceful there. Vi went up there because of the view. And they took their two dogs. Why did the two dogs go up there? Just for fun. Dogs are much smarter. They don't have a reason to do things. Just joy, happiness. And so they got halfway up Meditation Mountain. It was so peaceful there. Sam was very, very content. And Vi, even halfway up Meditation Mountain, that Vi could see a long distance. And she had a Canon camera. She was taking all these incredible insight snaps. And Metta the dog was getting happier and happier. And Anapanasati, the dog, was getting more, breathing more and more calmly as it got higher up Meditation Mountain. And when they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, wow, it was so peaceful. Sam was just so content and happy. It was incredible. Nothing moved on top of Meditation Mountain. Sam was just so wonderfully peaceful. But Sam had a pair of eyes as well. Sam could also enjoy an incredible view. As for Vi, she could see everything. The whole wisdom of samsara laid out before her. She was taking incredible insight shots. And put the camera this way, that's streamlining. Another shot, that's what's returning. Another shot, and that's non-returning. And the arahat shot, she could get everything, the whole wisdom. But she could also experience the peace as well, because the stillness and peace coexist. So the stillness and wisdom coexist on top of Meditation Mountain. And as for Metta the dog, Metta the dog was getting happier and happier and happier, because loving kindness and joy also coexist with the insight and with the stillness. And as for Anapanasati, the other dog, he disappeared. Couldn't find him. He'd gone. Because on top of Meditation Mountain, the breath vanishes. So, that is the story of Vi, Sam, Metta, and Anapanasati. And that they all go up Meditation Mountain together. There is no such thing as samatha meditation alone. No such thing as insight devoid of samatha. That is a myth. That is bad teachings. Ajahn Chah, he would put his hand up and say, now you see the front of my hand, you can't see the back. Now you see the back, you can't see the front. But the front is still there. It's just going right behind the back of the hand. You can't separate them. Vipassana samatha, vipassana samatha. They all go together. With metta as well. So I added the metta of the dog. Anapanasati, apparently I said that in a talk some time ago. Someone reminded me of that. But mostly metta, loving kindness, insight, and stillness. You can't separate them. So, if you all think you're doing insight meditation, and you've got no kindness, no stillness, sorry, you're not doing insight meditation. If you are doing stillness meditation, and you're getting no kindness, and you're getting no insight, sorry, that's not stillness meditation. That's usually going to sleep meditation. If you are doing loving kindness meditation, and you're not getting any stillness and insight, it's not real metta meditation. They all come together. So when you say, oh, you've just been doing samatha, when are we going to do vipassana? We've done vipassana. It comes along with samatha, and anyone who doubts what I'm saying, you can have a look in Anapanasati Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya. People have taught you quite wrongly that Anapanasati is samatha and satipatthana is insight. You heard that before? Gomayan. Remember the word Gomayan? If you have a look at how the Buddha taught, the big boss, the authority, Anapanasati Sutta, there you will see clearly anyone who practices Anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath, which I taught this morning, also fulfills the satipatthanas. So if you've done Anapanasati, that's insight practice. Fills the satipatthanas. They all come together. I know we try and separate things. And once we separate things, we say, samatha is better than vipassana. And I would say, no, vipassana is better than samatha. We get to spiritual materialism again. My path is better than your path. And that really sucks. That's really inappropriate. There's only one path. It is called Eightfold Path. And that's the only path which leads to enlightenment. Ezo wa mago nati anyo dasanasa visudhya. 372, verse 372 of the Dhammapada. I'm just saying that to impress you. I know my suttas. I can quote them. Check me out. And there you'll see what that means. This is the only path, there is no other, for the purity of insight. Eightfold path. This is the only path, there is no other. Eightfold path. So, Eightfold Path includes samatha, includes vipassana, includes metta, it includes keeping your precepts. So just one single path, not two. And if you do metta, the other two come along. If you do samatha, vipassana and metta come along. And if you do vipassana, you have to do samatha and metta as well. They all come together. It's really important you understand that. Because, number one, it makes it very easy what you're doing. You don't have to stop doing this and do something else. They all come together. But what it really is used for is, you know, if you are getting somewhere in your meditation. Yes, you may think, I'm getting great insights, I'm really understanding stuff. But if you're still as miserable as ever, no loving kindness at all, just wanting to just go and strangle the people in your hut, your cottage, who snore all the time and make so much noise, then you haven't got any insight. But if your loving kindness is really improving, you're getting more and more soft and smiley and more empathy for everyone on this retreat, and even the little ants which crawl on the ground, or the little flies, and all they really want to do is explore up your nose. If you've got so much kindness, oh, come on, you can come up my nose if you wish, then you've developed insight. That's a sign of insight, a kindness. That's a sign of stillness, insight. It's a sign of also kindness, stillness. They all go together. But a lot of times, because especially Westerners, we're so intellectual, we think insight is being able to give a great talk on dependent origination and Four Noble Truths and know the Abhidharma backwards. We think insight is just knowledge and being smart. Insight is what takes away things like greed, hatred and delusion. So you don't have hatred anymore. You've got beautiful loving kindness instead. So measure your progress by how much kindness you have. Dear Ajahn, how does stillness of the mind lead to wisdom and enlightenment? Okay, I tell this simile every time. And you've heard these similes before, but you know, sometimes you come up with a simile and it's a really good one. And this was my simile, if you've heard it before, the tadpole and the frog. A tadpole was born in the pond in Jhana Grove Retreat Center, just down there. And this tadpole was a very smart little tadpole. She went to tadpole school, did really, really well, and finished tadpole high school, so she went to university, just in the lake. And in there she studied chemistry. The show was so good, she carried on to do a PhD. And as somebody once told me, reminded about this a few days ago, what does PhD mean? What does it stand for? Permanent head damage. That's what somebody told me about a PhD. If you're a doctor, please, I apologise. That's only a joke. So don't damage my head because I made that joke. So anyway, she started a PhD, and her field of study was the nature of water. And because it was a Buddhist retreat centre, she also managed to get some teachings on Abhidharma. The Abhidharma, the nature of water. She was an expert on water. She lectured about water. She wrote whole theses and books about water. But frankly, how can a tadpole know what water is? She cannot understand water no more than a fish can. Because a fish has been born in water, lived all its life in water. How can a fish know what water is? But the difference between the tadpole and the fish is the tadpole. One day she wakes up and she's got things growing on her. Never seen those before. Legs and arms. She is becoming a frog. And once she's become a frog, she's swimming around in the lake and something happens. She doesn't know exactly what she did, but she jumped. And now she's standing on dry land. Weird. Never experienced anything like this at all in her life before. Because something which has always been there has now gone, vanished, disappeared. And what is that? Water. Only now can the tadpole understand what water is. Once it's gone. Now, that is a simile of stillness. Because from stillness, things vanish. They stop. I am going to mess around with your heads again. The will. Do you really understand what the will is? You've been swimming around in that water ever since you were conscious. Yeah, you don't always use the will, but it's always there whenever you need it. But when you get into the jhanas, it's weird, it's strange, like nothing you've experienced before. That's why this is a brilliant simile. Tadpole, a frog, has never experienced anything like this. It's totally new, scary sometimes, weird. And in these jhanas, many things are missing. One of them, will. Now you can understand what will is. Before, no way. You can study it. You can do psychology experiments on the will. You can cut up the brain and have a look, see what lights up when you do something. You can study the Abhidharma on the will. You can listen to every talk which Ajahn Brahm gives on the will. But do you think you understand it? No. That's why we get so confused when I talk like this. I'm just talking about water to a fish. Bit of a waste of time, really. Except you're all tadpoles, and one day you're not going to be a fish anymore. You're going to be a frog. You get jhanas. Weird. You notice many things are missing. That's where you get insight. Not through thinking, old thoughts, but seeing things you've never seen before. Real insight turns you upside down, inside out. You never expected that. You never saw emptiness coming. But here it is, and you cannot deny it. The world without water, existence without will. Woohoo! Scary stuff. For one day, you little tadpoles, you're going to start, many have already started growing a few appendages here and there. And one day you're going to just press the letting go button and disappear from this body and appear in jhana land. And there, when you come out afterwards, wow, many things were missing. That is how you get insight. It's obvious, isn't it? But anyway, you may not believe me, but one day it will happen. Dear Ajahn, the Kudaka Nikaya came out after all other Nikayas. Please write it carefully out of compassion for me. But the Kudaka Nikaya came out after all other Nikayas, I'm not really sure it did, because we have the story that after the Buddha passed away, that they decided to have a big meeting. 500 arahats met together. It's called the first, call it Sanghayana. What's that? The first meeting or whatever, conference. Sorry?
Sanghayana.
It's Sanghayana, yeah. The first convocation or conference, because the monks all thought that we should actually get all these teachings together. You heard one teaching, someone else heard something else, so let's also get it all together. And it said in all of the recensions of all the different types of Buddhism, they all agreed that at that first Sanghayana, that first meeting, that Ananda, or first of all, the monk, what's his name, Upali, he recited the Vinaya, the monks and the nuns' rules. And after that was completed, that Ananda, who had been so close to the Buddha, he recited all of the suttas, which was the five Nikayas. And we all know the five Nikayas, they haven't changed since. The Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, the Sanyutta Nikaya, the Anguttara Nikaya, and the Kudaka Nikaya. So according to that, which everybody agrees, that the Kudaka Nikaya, what you say here, that was also chanted at the first meeting. But one thing which was missing, Abhidhamma, that wasn't mentioned at all, as being chanted in the first meeting of the Sangha. And that's one little piece of evidence which suggests that the Abhidhamma came much later, after the time of the Buddha. But the Kudaka was there. So Abhidhamma was not. Da, da, da. And I get in big trouble when I say things like that, because people say, no, the Abhidhamma is the word of the Buddha. Quite frankly, I don't think it is. There's too much evidence to say it's not word of the Buddha. And that's a big relief to many of you, because studying the Abhidhamma is just so complicated. And actually, it doesn't actually taste like the word of the Buddha either. The Buddha actually taught in the local language, nice and easy to understand, with lots of similes. Now that is how the Buddha taught, so everybody could understand. You didn't have to be a professor of philosophy to understand it. There's lots and lots of other evidence to say the Buddha never taught the Abhidhamma. I'm sure I'm going to get a few questions about that tomorrow. But if you do the questions, please write in English, not in Pali, so I can understand it. Duratan, can the dairy farming be considered a right livelihood? Modern farming practice involve killing newborn male calves because they are not productive in milk industry. Your view is appreciated. I think one of the biggest problems is when it's factory farming. I haven't seen this in Western Australia. Now, we live in sort of a farming community, just farms down the road, up the road, all over the place. And, you know, those are just the old methods of farming. Just the cows are out there. Sometimes they come under our fences and come in here. You know, one interesting story once, they have cows up in the prison farm, and they use those for mostly slaughter, but for milk as well. And they were transporting some cows once in a truck. Now, from the prison, about 6 kilometres up the road, we don't know where they were taking them to, but one of those cows, when it was coming just past the gate of Bodhinyana Monastery, one of the cows jumped out of the truck and ran into the monastery. Sanctuary! And it was on a weekend. And sort of the truck stopped, and the people driving went in there to try and get the cow. And, you know, the monks, you know, didn't know what to do because, you know, they were junior monks. And I told them, well, if that ever happens again, if that cow makes it in the gate, say, we'll pay for it, sanctuary. That cow can stay here. But, you know, they took it away again, poor cow. It got so close, comes into our monastery, but, you know, they came and collected it and took it away afterwards. It's such a shame. So, it's modern farming practices, I think there is a way of stopping those modern farming practices. I think on the milk, the, you know, the free-range cows, and they make sure it really is free-range, it's not sort of factory farm. So at least there is some way we can actually be a bit more compassionate. Have you got any similes to explain dependent origination? Dependent origination, cause and effect. The simile which I gave yesterday. Yesterday, the day before yesterday, the simile of a flame on a candle. The flame on a candle is dependent. It arises because of three things. The wick, the wax, and heat. And if one of those things disappears, is taken away, the wick burns out, the wax gets all consumed, or, I always do that, the wind takes the heat away, then the flame is extinguished, because the flame is dependently originated from those three things, three causes. When one cause goes, the flame disappears. And it was the Buddha, I've said this before on this retreat, the Buddha was asked this question by Vajragotā, when an arahat, fully enlightened person, dies, where do they go? And the Buddha answered with a simile of the flame. A human being, even arahats, the Buddha, they're dependently originated. So when their causes stop, they disappear. But where do they go? Said Vajragotā. And the Buddha said, look, similar to flame. When the flame is extinguished, where does it go? The Buddha said, does it go east, west, north, south, up or down? But I like to make it more interesting. So I said, it goes to the ground of all flames. It goes to the ineffable place where flames exist, without needing to be caused anymore. It goes to the heaven realm of flames if they've been good, and the hell realm of flames if they've been bad. Because most flames are bad, they burn people. That's why the hell is full of flames. It's a fiery place. So if the flames have been good or bad, that depends where they go. That's stupid. No one ever thinks like that. When the flame is extinguished, it doesn't go anywhere. It's stopped. It's not there anymore. Zero, zip, finished, gone. But people always say, ah, if it's finished, that's like another word for nibbana. And I started having these stories about from Alice in Wonderland. Well, it could have been Alice through the Looking Glass. I think. Because in that you remember that it was a simile of a chessboard. And finally, Alice made it to the square of the Red Queen so she could be queened herself. And as she arrived on the square of the Red Queen asked her, sort of, where have you come from? And she said, oh, from the road up there. And she said, when you were on the road, did you actually see anybody? And Alice said, I saw no one on the road. And the Queen said, wow, what amazing eyes you have. It's enough for my eyes to see someone. That you can see no one means that your eyes must be really, really sharp. And he said, I'm expecting my messenger. And then the messenger suddenly, the messenger actually arrived. And the Queen said, you're very late, messenger. And he said, I went as fast as I could. I said, And the messenger said, no one runs faster than me. That's why I'm the Queen's messenger. No one runs faster than you. That's because no one came here before you. And actually this lady, this girl, Alice, she saw no one on the road. So you have to walk faster next time. And all the time it was making no one into a person. Nibbana into a state. Nothing, that's all. Gone. Keep it simple. But we always try to make something out of nothing. That is human stupidity. So, are you going to achieve the great nothingness? You can't achieve nothing. You give up achieving. And that's nothing. Emptiness. Nothing there. Gone. So that's a similar dependent origination. When the causes stop, the results stop. When the wick, the heat, or the wax is all gone, then the flame goes. Doesn't go anywhere. Wasn't really a thing in itself, it was just causes coming together. When the causes go, the result goes. And that's all you are. Nothing much. You are a nobody. And I saw this on a t-shirt. It's a very, very wise piece of advice. You are a nobody. And so on this t-shirt it said, nobody is perfect. I am a nobody, therefore I am perfect. And so you're all perfect because you're nobodies. And nobody's perfect. So there we go. So you don't need to do anything. You don't need to improve. You're perfect. Why? Because you're a nobody. And because nobody's perfect. End of problem. That's my simile for dependent origination. Okie dokie. Here we go. What is the meaning of full moon days in Buddhism? And does it help boost meditation practice? Oh yeah, it's a full moon day today. We just did our ceremony to go outside. A big full moon there. And what is the meaning of the full moon day? Oh, it was when you didn't have like news and TVs, how on earth do you know what day of the week it is or the day of month it is? You go and look up in the sky, you see the full moon, and that gives you like a calendar. So all the calendars a long time ago were all lunar calendars. And we still have that even in the West. Easter is a lunar. You find out what day is Easter by the full moons. So all of our culture was actually, you know, on moons. So that's how we knew. So once a month, full moon day was always a special day. And it seemed that those were the days when people get enlightened, like the Buddha, on a full moon day in Vaisak. It's a full moon day tonight. So this is your chance. It won't come again for another month. And to have a full moon day when you're at Jhana Grove is a very, very rare experience. So who knows, tonight, maybe your night. But does Buddhist meditate? It always has a lot of atmosphere on a full moon night. I know that sometimes people think, oh, romance on a full moon night. But don't get into romance. This is one of the myths about perception. I was talking about perception yesterday. Why is it, I keep on telling people, that you fall in love when you are walking with your partner under the moonlight, or in a nightclub, or what's the other place? At a party. There's one other place. Or by the river at night time. All the people fall in love when it's dark. That's right. At a candlelit dinner. That's also romantic. And I sometimes wonder, why are these romantic places? Candlelit dinner, moonlight, nightclub. Why are they romantic? What do they all have in common? Dark, yeah. What they have in common is you can't really see what you're falling in love with. No one ever falls in love in the middle of the day at noon in bright sunlight. Now you know why, don't you? It's because when it's dark, in the candlelight, in the moonlight, you know, you look at someone and you can fantasize, you can build this incredible, gorgeous picture. You know, that your old grandma is like Angelina Jolie. Yeah, it's amazing what the mind can do when it really wants to. At least you know what you're up to, you know, when you're candlelit dinner. Turn the lights on and then the romance is totally gone. But anyway, the moonlight is really nice because just enough light, but it's subdued light. Which means it calms the senses down. Bright light is you see so much. Now one of the worst places which I hate, I sometimes have to do this, going to shopping centres, you know, some business there or whatever, and it's just so bright in those shopping centres, and just such very harsh colours, and just, you know, smells, and they assault you. It's one of the worst places in the world in shopping centres, I think, anyway. It's just, everything is just so loud. And the total opposite is like a monastery or a retreat centre in the bush under the moonlight. Everything is just so soft and gentle. So you can understand why it's very good for meditation, because it's encouraging the mind to be not harsh, not loud, to be gentle, to be peaceful. So it does actually help your meditation when you get the beautiful, soft, peaceful light of the moon. So that's really helpful. How can we turn off genetically activated diseases within the body through meditation? Everyone says it can be done, but how? It's people keep telling me, I don't know too much about this, but that yes, you have many sort of genetic maybe faults in your DNA, but why are they expressed at this time and why are they not expressed at another time? And there's all other causes, not just your genetic disposition. So many other causes actually turn that genetic fault on or don't turn it on. And one of those conditions is the nature, you know, the surroundings, but also things like stress. Somebody showed me this beautiful TED talk of a lady. Did I say this first talk? Probably I did. This a woman who was investigating why some people get cardiac disease and why some people don't. And they were all in stressful jobs. And realized it was nothing to do with their genes. It was their attitude to their work. Those who looked upon their stressful job as a challenge. Something they can do, something they enjoy doing. You know, we like challenges sometimes. You know, we seek them. We go and have a tennis match. We enjoy it. Even though it's very stressful. So it was totally to do with your attitude at work. And people with the same amount of stress, the same amount of duties, some did not get any cardiac disease at all because their attitude never expressed those genes which created cardiac disease. Attitude is really very powerful. What is the Pali word for Noah? Thank you. Sati, mindfulness. Or vinyana, quite a few of them. Are there any issues with leaning on the chair back rest when meditating? Thank you. It depends on how far you lean back. If you lean back and the chair actually goes forward, backwards, backwards, there's a problem, you might fall over. So as long as the front legs of the chair don't lift off the floor, then you are fine. In fact, I just again read a science article, someone showed it to me, that the most comfortable position for your back, the healthiest position, is 15 degrees from the vertical. Leaning back on the chair is the healthiest for your back. So says doctors. And I probably agree with that. So if you really, really want to have a healthy back, get on a chair and lean back. And most of the chairs are about that 15 degrees. It's just the evolution of a chair. The ones which are successful, which make you feel good, those are the ones which have survived. And that's why we always have about a little leaning back on the chair. So that's the best. Are devas able to help humans in sickness, prosperity, protection, etc.? Sometimes they can help you, but they cannot be trusted. There was a fellow in Perth, told me the story, at home one afternoon, by himself, his wife was out shopping, I don't know what, and heard the deva. And the deva said, go to the casino. And he thought, oh, well, what's this? This is crazy stuff. I'd imagine it. I'm just hearing things. But he knows no one in the room. And he heard it again. Go to the casino. Really clearly, as if someone was standing right next to him. And he thought, well, this is absolutely crazy. I'm going mad. Third time. Go to the casino. And his grandfather had just died or something, so he thought, you know, the ghost was actually helping him. So why not? Wasn't doing anything. So he took a little bit of money, you know, went to the casino, went in there, and as he was going through the door of the casino, he heard the voice again. Go to the roulette table. Go to the roulette table. He heard it very clearly. So why not? So, you know, cashed maybe about $50 of chips or something, not much, because he didn't have much. He went to the roulette table. And then when he was at the roulette table, he heard the voice again. No one else heard it, just him. Put $50 on number 6. Put $50 on number 6. Why not? So he put the whole $50 of chips on number 6. And the croupier, you know, the guy who actually twirls the wheel, threw the board in, went round and round and round and round, and it fell on number six. Wow. And he heard the voice say again, put all the winnings on number 22. Oh no, first of all, he heard the whatever it was say, yes, yes. That's very important, the story. Yes, yes. And put all the winnings on number 22. Put it all on number 22. So why not? He put it all on number 22. And the croupier twirled the wheel, threw in the ball round and round and round, went on number 22. And he heard the spirit say, woohoo, woohoo! And he won some serious money. But the spirit said, put all the money, everything on number 17. Put it all on number 17. And he started wondering, because he already had a lot of money. You know, you get two successive numbers, $50, that's a lot of money. You accountants have probably already worked out how much it is. I don't know, but a lot of money. But why not just go for broke? So he thought, okay. So he put all the winnings on number 22. And he was really excited. And the croupier turned the wheel and threw the board and went round and round and round. And it went into number 22. And then jumped out to the number next. And he heard the spirit say very clearly, oh shit. As the spirits would if they make a mistake like that. So the moral of that story is, you can't trust spirits just because they're supernatural. They make mistakes as well. So yeah, devils can help humans in sickness, prosperity, protection, but most of the time, you know, they are just fallible like us. So, but a lot of times, I mean, why would they help you for? What have you done for them? And they're very busy. They've got other things to do in their life. So instead of waiting for a devil to help you if you're sick, try a doctor. If you want to be prosperous, forget about devas. Go to work. If it's protection, don't go to stupid places where you're liable to get hurt. So you don't need protection in this place. This is just a beautiful place. Nothing happens here. So devas can protect you, but you can protect yourself much better. When will one not be reborn? Is it when desires are extinguished? Yes, all desire, even the desire not to be reborn. In other words, when you become so still, so quiet, that nothing moves. When nothing moves, things disappear. When they disappear, you disappear. And when the bus comes to take you to the next rebirth, they look around and they can't see you because you've vanished. Stillness. Is it possible for Nimitta Jhana to appear before completely stage four, sustaining full breath? Thank you. Sort of. Because sometimes just people are saying, press the letting go button. The reason why we do the breath is because it's, I call it the stepping stone. You know, another way of looking at this meditation, you're living in the world of the body and the five senses, the will, the ordinary world. We're trying to cross the stream, you know, going into the world of the mind. So the five senses have stopped, they're gone, the mind is very still into that realm. But it's hard to cross that stream. It's sometimes a bit wide for too many people. So we've got a little stepping stone in the middle. So you let go of all of your body, everything except of your breath. So you can't feel your head, you can't feel your toes, you can't feel your arms. There's no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste. All you got is your breath, nothing else. That's like a stepping stone, halfway across. And from the breath, it's pretty, easier to go from just watching the breath to the breath disappearing, and with it, the whole of the body going into the realm of the mind. So it's like, you know, it's a halfway place. That's why the breath is very useful. Of course, some people just jump over the whole thing in one go, but then they can't get back there again because they don't know how it works. So sometimes people just have these fruit nimittas, fruit jhanas, and they don't know how to get back again. So you have to get practicing. So all these different stages with our talk this morning, they're really helpful. That's the best way. Dear Ajahn, in mindfulness of the breath, some traditions talk of mindfulness at the tip of the nose. In some, it's the rising and falling of the abdomen. Others suggest the full body experience of the breath. What is your recommendation? Three possibilities there, each one, go Mayang. And there's good reason the Buddha never said, ever, to watch the nose. It's called breath meditation, not nose meditation. It's not belly meditation. It's breath meditation. And when it says the full body of the breath, which is the third stage of Anapanasati, the Buddha explains it in Anapanasati Sutta. This is the breath because the breath counts as one of the bodies. You're not watching the body, you're watching the breath, for goodness sake, at that stage. So, mindfulness at the tip of the nose. I have to do this at every meditation retreat. Because when, you know, I was taught just watch the breath. So it's very easy to watch the breath, but watch the tip of the nose. Sometimes I couldn't find the breath there. You know why? Because it wasn't there, it was somewhere else. I had hay fever, my nose was blocked. So there's no air going in the nose. So it was a waste of time trying to do breath meditation at the tip of the nose when nothing was happening there. That was actually quite helpful, because I learned instead to watch the breath rather than the nose. But later on, when I was actually going to Malaysia first. The first time I went to Malaysia, that people were complaining about meditation headache. And I didn't know, what are you talking about? Meditation used to get rid of headaches, to get healthy, to get happy. What on earth are you getting a headache for? And it took me a while to understand why people were getting meditation headache in Malaysia, because they were all taught to watch the tip of the nose. And in order to explain what I mean, in this little exercise, I take off my glasses and I meditate on the tip of my nose with my eyes open. And this is what you do with your eyes closed. You don't realize you're doing this. When you watch the tip of the nose, your eyes also start to watch the tip of the nose. You go cross-eyed under your eyelids and you don't really know because you're watching the tip of the nose, not just with your mind. Whatever your mind focuses on, your eyeballs focus on as well. And that means that after a few minutes, you get a tension headache. If I keep being cross-eyed for a few minutes longer, I'll get a headache too. And honestly, that's no joke. That's what people are doing. Stressing their mind out by stressing their eyeballs as well. Many people do that. And so to stop that, you don't watch the breath at the tip of the nose. You watch the breath, wherever it happens to be. And the belly meditation. That one monk told me this, and I totally agree with him. He said, the belly meditations may be okay in the morning time, but please don't do it at this time of the night, when you're on 8 precepts. Because if you watch your belly rise and fall, it's so close to your stomach. You get hungry. Oh, I'm hungry. I want something to eat. It's not fair. It's right next door. And so the mindfulness just feels the hunger there. So that's not a good idea either. So just watch the breath. But people who have never meditated before, they're so easy to teach. I just tell them, close your eyes. Watch 3 in-breaths, 3 out-breaths. At the end of the 3rd breath, open your eyes. They can all do that. And I don't tell them where to watch it. Do it naturally, wherever the breath happens to be, that's where you watch. It makes it much more simple. How is transcendental meditation different to this one? Is it one more effective than the other? The main difference is you have to pay a lot of money for transcendental meditation, and this is for free. As my predecessor Ajahn Chakra used to say, the cheapest and the best. Good value for money. That's the only difference. Can human beings be possessed by spirits? Yes, they can. They can be possessed by bottles of whiskey, gin. You open up the bottle, start drinking it, and you get possessed. And you know it's possessed because you can't walk in a straight line. You speak all differently, and you're not yourself anymore. So yes, you can get possessed by those sorts of spirits. But the other spirits, very, 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 very rare. Did the Buddha predict how long this era of Buddhism will last? If so, how long did he say we've got until it's all over? You've only got a few more days. So you'd better practice no sleep. No, the Buddha never made any predictions like that. It wasn't the Buddha's way to make predictions, like it wasn't Ajahn Chah's way to make predictions. Buddhist monks, real Buddhist monks and nuns, don't make predictions. People love, they try and ask you, come on, tell us the future. I know you understand the future, Ajahn Brahm, tell us your future. And this was a story of Ajahn Chah. If you haven't heard this one, this is a brilliant one which answers this question better than I could ever answer it. A young man came up to Ajahn Chah and said, I want you to predict my future, to read the lines on the palm of my hand. Ajahn Chah said, good monks don't do that. This man, this supporter, was ready for that response. And he told Ajahn Chah, in the last talk you gave on the full moon day, you gave a talk on gratitude. I have been feeding you, giving donations to this monastery. This is the first time I've asked for anything. Come on, show some gratitude. Read the lines on the palm of my hand. Never try to outwit, outsmart a good Buddhist monk. So Ajahn said, okay, give me your hand. And so this man was so excited. He was going to get the lines on his hand read by one of the great masters of Thailand. And he knew that whatever Ajahn Chah said must be true, because monks don't lie, and great monks always know much more than they ever expect. So he was really excited. Imagine, you're getting your palms of your, the only one ever to have this, from the great Ajahn Chah. He was so excited. He couldn't wait till Ajahn Chah was finished. That's why Ajahn Chah went really slowly. He was a joker, that monk, but really amazing one. He took his finger and he started tracing the lines really, really slowly, concentrating, focusing. And this guy was getting more and more wound up, because every now and again Ajahn Chah would stop and change his expression. Oh, well. And he'd carry on. And this guy was getting more and more excited. Well, and he couldn't wait for him to finish. And eventually Ajahn Chah finished. He said, well, what is it? What's my future going to be? And Ajahn Chah said something like, I will never make mistakes. I know you don't make mistakes. I'm not going to stop telling you exactly what I've seen. Yes, I know. Tell me what it is. And what I say, you can trust is going to be, yeah, I know that. Get on with it. What's my future going to be? And Ajahn Chah looked him in the eye and said, your future, sir. Yes, 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 yes. Your future is uncertain. And Ajahn Chah wasn't wrong. He doesn't lie. And that was just one way of making a very strong and powerful teaching, which that guy never forgot. Your future, you cannot predict the future because it's uncertain. That's the only prediction you can make. So how long will this Buddhism last? It's uncertain. It's up to you and me how long we make it last. That's the answer. Anyway, next. Children at the schools are taught to achieve, pass exams, be competitive, get the top jobs and so on. However, Buddhism teaches let go, be happy with what you get, don't push yourself to the limit. How do the two concepts go together? Why no Buddhists achieve the Nobel Prize? And they have achieved the Nobel Prize. Brian Josephson, Josephson Junction, he's a meditator, he's in Cambridge, he's a Nobel Prize laureate. I think there's quite a few Buddhists who probably won the Nobel Prize. Bob Dylan, Nobel Prize for, was he a Buddhist? Bit of a scallywag, but anyway. So, your children at school. I've said this in public many, many times. If you are a Buddhist, and if you consider to be a disciple of the Buddha, and if your child comes in the top 5% or wins the prize in the end of the year exams, or they come in the bottom 5%, they're not good Buddhists. You haven't been a good Buddhist father to them. You know why? Because in Buddhism we believe in the middle way. So if your child comes in the middle somewhere, that's the best Buddhist parent you can possibly have. And I say that in public so often. The kids come along and parents say, come on, you can do better than that. So no, Ajahn Brahm said middle way. They blame me for that. If your kids are actually naturally smart, fine. Passing exams. I always thought you had to pass exams. And once I passed one exam, you had another one next year. And you pass that exam, and then another one afterwards. You pass that, another exam, until I figured it out. You have to keep doing exams until you fail one. And it's better to fail one early on than you don't have to have so much stress doing all the other ones. That's what I tell kids. Kids really love my teachings. They think, wow, this is really cool. So, emotional intelligence, you may have read that book by Davidson, that academic success is no measure of success in life. This fellow, he saw this and he wondered, you know, why is it that people who get, you know, all the double first honours, you know, in great universities, why they never make a success in life? Look at me, I bombed out. I never got my Nobel Prize. I ended up not having a job. Being a monk. I got a good degree. But he noticed it's not your academic intelligence, not your IQ. He called it EQ. Your ability to actually to be at peace with yourself, to relate to others. The emotional intelligence, that was a greater predictor of success in life than your passing exams. And sometimes I wonder about that. In schools, we are pushing and asking the kids to actually to learn the wrong things. Competition is good, but what about cooperation? I felt really bad about this when I was doing exams. I was competing against my friends, some of my best friends. I didn't feel comfortable about that. I couldn't help my best friend. If I saw they were stuck on a question during the exam, I couldn't come and help them. That's what I wanted to do. So I often thought that maybe change the school system. So every year, say, you know, year 12 or first year at university, that maybe 70%, 80% of your marks are your personal score, and 20 or 30% are averaged over the class to which you belong. So it's worthwhile to cooperate and help people in your class who are weaker than you. Because that's what real life is like. In an office, in a monastery, we have to help one another. Yeah, competition is helpful as well, but cooperation is even more helpful. So why can't we reward cooperation in our schools? Which means that we give a score, a group of kids, 3 or 4 or 5. If they all do well, good score. If they don't do well, they all get bad score. So cooperation is rewarded. And then we're actually getting a far, far better system, which is much better to real life and also to Buddhism as well. Top jobs? Who wants a top job? You have to be crazy. Look, I mean, why was it that the two people vying to be President of the United States were both really bad candidates? The reason is because no real sane person would ever want to be President of the United States. Who would want that job? Crazy person. You have to be a megalomaniac, really egotistical, up themselves. That's the only way that people would actually volunteer for a job like that. So I think, okay, we should change the way we elect our leaders. We shouldn't elect our leaders by popular vote. We should select them, just like they do in a company. And they don't have to be Australian to be the Prime Minister of Australia. There are other good candidates in other countries who are out of a job. You know, maybe like, say, David Cameron. He's out of a job now, so maybe we could elect him as Prime Minister of Australia. At least he wouldn't have any sort of baggage, and you know, he may be able to give. Why does it have to be a member of your country to be your Prime Minister? Maybe we could the President of the United States. Maybe we could give that to Kofi Annan. Interesting. You don't have to. Maybe even give it to Attenborough. But why is it that you have to be a member of that country to be the president? Can't you just widen the field so you can get the very, very best? Anyway, that's my idea, to just to change everything so we can get the very best. So anyway, why no Buddhist achieved Nobel Prize? Yes. Please share with us your challenges, trials and tribulations while doing your 6-month retreat, so we mere mortals may gain inspiration and benefit from it. Thank you and many merits. No trials, no tribulations. Why do you think there was a trial and tribulation? You let go and enjoy it. That's how you manage. So I don't know why people always think that meditation is hard and being a monk is tough. This is the best time of my life. It's wonderful being a monk. People, it must be really tough being a monk. Even worse being a nun. None of this, none of that. It's wonderful life. So that's why I can't understand why more people don't actually join up being monks and nuns. What are we doing in your life anyway? You're always complaining about, not enough money. You don't need money as a monk. The wife is always just moaning at me. The husband never does the work. You don't have a husband and wife in a monastery. The kids, always worried about the kids. You don't have kids. You're just so free as a monk or as a nun. The best lifestyle ever. I don't know why more people don't actually just queue up trying to get in. Anyway, if I had to guess what you were in your past life by looking at you, I would say you were a marshmallow, pink and round and soft. Comment, not a question. Thank you very much. No, I was a donut. That is my name, Ajahn Donut. That's what they call me now. And the reason they call me Ajahn Donut is I am round, I am sweet, and holy in the middle. So donut is the best. I never made that up. Someone else made that up, I think, in Singapore, and I thought, wow, really cool. What happens after we experience the light, especially when it gets really bright? You get happy. So, just go for it. You're totally safe. Having a wonderful time. Oh, actually, I should be more honest with you. There is a danger. I haven't said the danger of when you see this beautiful nimittas and get into jhanas. There is one and only one danger, but to be fair with you, I should warn you about this. If you get into jhanas, there's a very good chance you're going to lose all your hair. You're going to become a monk or a nun. So that's what happens after you experience the light. Especially when it gets really bright, your hair falls out. You explained, you know, that sometimes people have cancers and they don't have any hair. You're really cool when you don't have hair, just like us. But people always have these fundraisers. They shave your hair off to raise money for something or other. And I volunteered for that. Raised money for cancer by shaving my hair off, and they wouldn't accept it. So they said, why don't you grow your hair for cancer research? Think that'd be a good idea? I'll grow my hair for cancer research. And you can actually sponsor it by the inch. No, that's... that'd be totally unrecognisable. No, I can't do that. Anyway, you experience how the nimittas look like and run out of time. How do the first to the fourth jhanas and beyond, Sowat Anagami, look like? Mega merits to you. They don't look like anything. It's just disappearing. More and more things vanish. So, in the first jhana, what vanishes? Your body vanishes. No body anymore. It's too far away from you. Somebody shouted at you, Ananda, Ananda. You can't hear it. If they hit you on the head with a hammer, you wouldn't feel it. You are totally out of your body. Not floating outside in the world.
in the realm of the mind. You can't feel your body. Your body, as I mentioned to you, is totally safe. So, that's what the first jhana feels like. Second jhana, something else vanishes. That's actually the will. That's where you get really still, the second jhana. Yeah, most of the will is gone in the first jhana, but second jhana is totally still. You can't do anything. Absolutely still. Nothing moves at all. Rock. That's what that feels like. And that's weird and beautiful. That's why you stay many, many hours. You can't get out. There's no will. There's no button to press anymore to exit. All the buttons have gone. The third jhana, just a totally different type of happiness. The third to the fourth jhana is happiness is vanishing. But when it vanishes in the fourth jhana, it's no happiness. And that's the happiest you can ever be is have no happiness. Does that make any sense to you? That's what it's like. Totally peaceful. Oh, this is sweet. That's like the top of Meditation Mountain. Nothing moves, and absolutely peaceful. And the streaming in, once returning, etc., what do they look like? This is just when you become a streamwinner, you see there's nobody in here, so what the heck are you worrying about? The world is not you. The one who knows is not you either. Just an empty process. Just cause like the flame on a candle. So you're not worried about it anymore. So you can let go. The reason why you can let go is because there's no one actually to do anything. So you let go more and more. And as you let go more and more, you become more still and more things vanish. You fade away. The great disappearing act. Poof. And you're gone. That's the arahat who passes away. Totally vanished. Not even David Copperfield could vanish like an arahat can. Okay, last question before you all vanish. Dear Ajahn, please explain nibbana, blowing out, vanishing. Yes, exactly. I never actually mentioned to you that when the candle flame is extinguished, you know what the word for extinguishing a candle flame is in Pali? Nibbana. They use that word from common usage. I often say every kid, when the monks or the Buddhas mentioned nibbana, would understand exactly what he meant. Because they didn't have candles, they had oil lamps. They're just like in Sri Lanka, the oil lamps. And when the oil lamp went out, they say, "Oh, oil lamp's nibbana'd, please light it again, son." It was a common word. So that's why in those days they'd understand exactly what it meant when the Buddha said, you know, nibbana. But these days, nibbana becomes a place where we go, the ultimate retirement home for you. Where, just like because we believe in these fantasies, we were brought up with the fantasies of Hollywood and Walt Disney, that they're like Prince Charming finds Cinderella, and they ride off into the distance, happy ever after. And that's what we want. You get enlightened, and you ride off with your beautiful mind into the sunset, happy ever after. Ha ha ha. It doesn't work like that. Prince Charming and Cinderella have arguments about what furniture they want to have in the palace and whether they want to spend the money on a holiday or a kitchen renovation. Then they have kids and now that really destroys Prince Charming and Cinderella's happiness. But it only goes to the sunset, never what happens the next dawn. Same with we always want to live happily ever after. And enlightenment becomes another one of those types of heavens. If you become enlightened, then you can live happily ever after. Impossible. So you just disappear. Vanish. And that's happiness. Is nibbana an ultimate reality and therefore permanent, or is it still anicca? It's nothing. It's gone. Disappeared. Can you explain two types of nibbana while still living and while not living? One is when all of your will to do something to get reborn, all that's disappeared.
And it's like the workman waiting for the wages. The first type of nibbana, when you're an arahat, it's like you've done the job, the check's in the mail. Has anyone ever said that to you? The check's in the mail. Actually, just the cleaners in Jhana Grove, they were with me the other day. And they said, when are you going to pay us for the cleaning you did? And I said, actually, the check's in the mail. And so we've heard that one before. Actually, the check was in the mail. You know, I posted it myself, you know, that morning. So sometimes when people say the check's in the mail, the check actually is in the mail. It's not always a lie. You know, because we did a lot of building and built this place and built Bodhinyana Monastery, we were waiting for the concrete truck to arrive once, and it was late. So I got on the telephone, rang the concrete company, and said, where's our concrete truck? It should have been arrived here by now. I said, oh, we were a bit delayed. It's the truck has just left the yard. Now, if you ever get that, that's also like, you know, the checks in the mail. It's a lie. But I believed them because you've got to be trustworthy as a monk. So I waited another half an hour, still hadn't arrived. So I called them again. I got another operator this time. And I said, oh, where's our truck? And he said, oh, it's just left the yard. And I said, hang on a minute, the other guy said the same. And he got really embarrassed. And he said, okay, I'll go check it out for you. It hasn't left the yard, I'm terribly sorry, but I'll make sure it does soon. Or just like even the once I called one of the presidents of a Buddhist society some time ago. And you know, I got through to the house, but talking to her daughter, she's about 6 years old, said, I want to speak to your mum, it's Ajahn Brahm here. And I said, I want to speak to your mummy. And the daughter said, I'm sorry, mummy's not in. I said, I'm Ajahn Brahm. And so I could hear her say, mummy, it's Ajahn Brahm, are you in? She really got embarrassed. You're supposed to be the president of the Buddhist society, that's how you train your children, terrible. But it happens sometimes. So the two types of arahat, the one who's still alive, the check's in the mail, the one who parinibbana's, they receive the check. They disappear, vanish. There we go. And that is the end of the questions and answers this evening. So, those of you who haven't got enlightened yet, the truck's left the yard, are you believing that? No, probably not. It's not true. Some of you may have left the yard yet, but some of you are still sitting in the yard. But who knows? Maybe tonight, because it's the full moon night, maybe tonight you'll get the check. Who knows? So anyway, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Always make it different every time, because it's so boring doing the same old stuff every time. So okay, have a wonderful evening. See you in the morning if you're still alive. If you're dead, never mind. Great place to die, this. And tomorrow, for those of you who are wondering, tomorrow the question will be answered. The teddy bears. I promise to tell you tomorrow what we got. So we got so many teddy bears here. So that's exciting. Coming tomorrow at a retreat center close to you. When there's nothing to do, sit down and have a cup of tea. That's the difference between, about not getting involved with things with care and compassion. When there's something to do, care, have compassion. But sometimes there's nothing to do. So learn how to sit down and do nothing. We all know how to do things. You've been trained in that, you're great at it. But sitting down and doing nothing, that is something you haven't learned to do yet, which is what we're teaching you here. Okay, now, I've got to get my mind back to your best ghost hunting experience when I was a student. That's really getting back to a long time ago. So I cannot actually recall right now ghost hunting as a student. But maybe some of the ghost stories from a time in Thailand, maybe. What's a nice ghost story from a time in Thailand? Well, it's actually not a ghost hunting story, but when there was the place where we lived in Thailand, all those places where the forest monasteries were, there were also cremation grounds as well. So over in, say, Wat Nanachat, there was lots and lots of funerals, burnings. And because they were just so basic, you know, the person would die in the morning, and just in the afternoon or evening, they would just get a big pile of wood, and in a very cheap coffin, because they couldn't afford anything much, they put the body on top in the coffin, and we would light it, and would watch it burn. And they always had to make sure that the body was put on the side, never on the back. Because sometimes it actually moved because it was wood, and you know, when this fire was lit, it sometimes settled, it would sometimes go on its back. And it was just the way that when the body gets burnt and some of the muscles contract, some expand. I saw this myself. The body would be on its back being burnt, and the coffin surrounding it would soon burn away. You could see the body there, you know, the whole body. And because the back was receiving the flames first of all, the body would sit up and the hand would rise and point to somebody. I never did anything, not me. So that's why it always had to be put on the side. Sometimes you'd wedge pieces of the wood in there to make sure it didn't do that. So there's many, and sometimes some people took so long to burn. And sometimes I had to do that. You'd be with the fire, you know, most of the night, you know, and making sure like an arm would fall off the fire, you had to get a stick and put it back on the fire again. And you had to do that because there was dogs around. And the dogs were waiting for something to eat. So you had to whack them with the stick and just put the arm back on the thing to, out of respect for the person who died. It was really good fun. I love stuff like that. That's why I would do that sort of stuff. But on this night, it was like the moon night. The full moon's up now. It's a great time for ghosts. And the moon was up. So that night, we'd stay up meditating all night. Now, in these monasteries, always have these little monks, novice monks. Now, the novice monks would usually stay up to about 10 o'clock, and then they'd sneak off and just go and take a snooze and nap. They were only young kids, fair enough. You know, they weren't supposed to do that, but of course we let them go because they were very young. But this night, one of those novice monks, he refused to leave the hall. But to get to his room, he had to go through the forest in the dark. Just after there'd been a funeral that morning. And he was so sure the ghost was around, because he was freshly dead. That's when the ghosts are really active. And so he just refused to leave that hall, even though he was dying to rest. But going without sleep was not that hard. What was really hard, he really needed to go to the toilet. And he couldn't go to the toilet in the hall. And he was bursting, but the toilet was also outside, through the forest. And so he was holding on, but so scared to go through the dark forest to get to the toilet. He was holding on, and he was so scared, but it was hurting so much. He was getting more and more scared, but it was hurting too much. And so he made a run for it. He ran to the toilet. And he got inside the toilet, you know, the old squat toilets in Asia, and sat down and urinated. Oh, relief. But then he heard some footsteps coming towards the toilet block, coming towards his cubicle. And then he heard scratching on the door, at which he didn't just urinate, he did the other one as well. And he never came out of that toilet cubicle all night until it was dawn. This poor little novice. And he said, why did you spend so long in there? He said, a ghost came to try and get into my toilet cubicle. It was the one who died today. I was so scared, I stayed there all night. You know, there's only tiny cubicles. And he swore, he said, I heard it scratching. And of course we told him what it really was. It wasn't a ghost. There was these little civet cats who live in the forest. And the toilet bowl, the squat toilets, that was where it went for a drink of water every night. And so this little civet cat, he was just scratching, please, I'm thirsty. Please give me some water, let me in. But for that poor little novice, he thought it was a big ghost come to get him. That's usually what happens. These aren't real ghosts. They're usually some other explanation for what these things truly are. Except sometimes they are real ghosts. The scary ghost stories, most of the ghost stories I know aren't that scary. I'm just trying to think of a real scary one. Oh, many of you know all my scary ghost stories, but you remember the coffin ghost? Even if you already remember it, I love telling it. And many kids keep on telling me, please, Agent Brown, tell the coffin ghost story. But this is a story. Here we go. This is a story. How many people haven't heard it? Anyone not haven't heard the coffin ghost? Oh, a few. Excellent. Marvellous. A fellow came to the temple to listen to a talk one evening. And after the talk, really nice talk, but it was pretty late when he had to walk home. And the usual way of walking home along the streets, but he decided this evening to take the shortcut across the cemetery. He wasn't afraid of ghosts, so he thought. But he went across the cemetery, and when you pass the cemetery, the lights are never as bright as along the road. It was dark and a little bit spooky, but it was saved him a lot of time. He got halfway across the cemetery, nothing had happened. It was going well. Three quarters of the way across the cemetery, and that's when he started hearing something behind him. You know what it's like sometimes? You're sure that somebody's following you and look around, can't see anything. But he didn't dare look around. He just walked a little bit faster. And as he was walking a little bit faster, because of fear, his awareness, his mindfulness was getting stronger and stronger. He was really listening. And he could swear he could hear something following him behind. Bump, bump, bumping behind him. And he went even faster. And whatever it was keeping up with him, actually catching up. Bump, bump, bump. He made a fatal mistake. He decided to look around. And what he saw almost gave him a heart attack. Because what he saw following him was a coffin. A vertical coffin, still with the earth falling off it and cobwebs all over. Bump, 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 following him. So he ran as fast as he could. Doesn't matter how fast he ran. Bump, bump, bump. The coffin was coming after him and catching up. Fortunately, his house was not that far away. Bump, bump, bump. He came to his gates. He jumped over the gate. Didn't have time to open it because the coffin was catching up. Bump, 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 bump. He got to the front door. He looked around. The coffin was at the garden gate. Bump, bump. Crashed through the garden gate. He put his hand in his pocket to get his keys out. He dropped them. He dropped his keys. Bump, bump, bump. As the coffin was getting closer, he picked up the first key, hoping it was the right one. Put it in the lock. Very lucky it was the right one. Turned it, went in the door, slammed the door just as the coffin came to the front. He could see it through the window of the front door. He made it. He was sweating. His heart was palpitating. He made it.
Bob! As the coffin started to hit the front door, bump! With enormous force, supernatural force, the hinges started to splinter. So he ran up the stairs, the only room in the whole house with a lock, the toilet. Bump! As the coffin broke down the front door. And he saw at the bottom of the stairs, there was the coffin looking for him. And saw him at the top of the stairs. Bump, bump, bump. Up the stairs. He ran into the toilet, slammed the door and locked it.
But look, if that coffin can break down a garden gate and a front door, what hope is there for a toilet door to protect him?
Bump!
As the toilet door started to splinter and give way,
bump!
There was nowhere else to run. He braced himself on the wall, the back wall of the bathroom.
Bump!
As the coffin broke through, there was no more place to run.
Bump!
As it came closer to him, instinctively he reached for something on the shelf. It was a bottle of medicine. He threw it at the coffin. And it broke. All the glass shattered and this brown liquid went all over that coffin. And the coffin stopped, never moved again. Because what he'd thrown was cough medicine. It stops the coffin. Okay, that's enough tonight. Sadhu! 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 That was a coughing story. Okay, enough. See you in the morning. If you have any weird dreams about coughings following you, you know where it came from. Even though you've all heard that before, it's nice to a golden oldie.